Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Skillscape. I'm your host, Justin Chu. We have a very special guest today, Patrick Lee, the co-founder and founding CEO of Rotten Tomatoes, the world's best movie review website. We also have a very special giveaway where you can get the chance to speak to Patrick and ask him any questions about his experiences. You can even use this opportunity to discuss your own ideas and projects. Catch the latest updates on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, and enjoy this episode. Patrick, it's so awesome to have you in on the podcast today. I'm really excited to finally get to have this conversation with you and be able to share that with the Skillscape audience. So once again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yep, thanks for having me, Justin.
Cool. To kick things off, Patrick, could you introduce yourself to us and what your journey has been like to entrepreneurship over the past, two decades or so?
Sure. So really quick, my parents born in China, grew up in Taiwan, went to the States for grad school. I was born in LA. After 2 years of college, I decided I wanted to try to be an entrepreneur. So I left school. I convinced 3 other friends to leave school with me. And we decided, we tried to do our first company together. Overall, I've done 6 different startups. Third was Rotten Tomatoes. Most of my startups failed. In total, those 6 companies was across a period of 23 years. And the last few years, I've just been taking a break, doing a lot of speaking, mentoring, advising startups, getting involved with a couple of different organizations and putting together events. And then most recently with COVID, no more events. And I recently got involved with an organization called Mozilla. They're running their accelerator program called Mozilla Builders. So I came on board as a mentor there. And so I've been kind of busy with that.
Right. It's such a privilege again to be talking to you. That was a very good introduction to sort of just ground our discussion. And I really want to focus in a little bit about Rotten Tomatoes first. Rotten Tomatoes is a household name. Concept is really simple. But why do you think it took off at the time that it did, or at least you were able to secure that first million? And was it the value proposition of that product? Was it just riding the wave of the internet bubble at that time? So what was that like, at the very beginning?
Right. So when Rotten Tomatoes started, we were actually doing a design firm called Design Reactor, and we were doing a lot of work for the entertainment industry. So a lot of stuff for Disney Channel. We were probably the lead developer, biggest developer for them at the time. We were working with ABC. We did the online flash game for a show called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And just working with lots of different entertainment companies. So our creative director, Sen Duong, came up with the idea for Rotten Tomatoes just on the side. From idea to launch, it took him about 2 weeks to put it out there. He couldn't code at the time, so he built it all in static HTML. And when he put it out there, just kind of started working almost immediately, got featured on Netscape and Yahoo. Roger Ebert wrote an article pointing out his favorite movie websites, and Rotten Tomatoes was one of them. And I remember when Pixar released A Bug's Life, we saw a spike in traffic, and it was coming from Pixar. And these were all within the first year of launch, when Sen was just doing it on the side as a hobby. So after that first year, we decided, maybe this could be a business. So I went to talk to Sen. Instead of him doing it by himself on his free time, no real resources, I was like, maybe we can just merge our companies, because our design firm, we had 20-something people, try and go out, pitch it, raise some money on it, and then run it as a real company. And he agreed to that. So we did that. I went out, raised $1 million, pretty much almost all from our clients of our design firm, because they already knew what we could do. And we showed them hey, look at what's going on with this website. Seems interesting. So we raised money for Rotten Tomatoes. We transferred our whole team over, and this was in January of 2000. And then kind of the market crashed 2 months later, and it was a very interesting ride from there.
Right. And before we get into that, which is a whole nother topic to discuss about. So what was the revenue model like initially back then?
Right. So when we first started, the site wasn't making any money, but it was growing in traffic. For us, what we realized was Rotten Tomatoes is the place where people decide what to watch. And that's a good position to be in, because they're basically ready to consume something, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's buy a movie ticket, buy a DVD, rent a DVD, et cetera. So it's a good decision point. Back then, most websites were generating revenue from advertising. I would say the majority of them were. There were some outliers eBay or Amazon, and they all survived and they did well. But most of these companies, they're generating revenue through advertising. When the bubble burst, almost all of them went out of business. because the advertising revenue dried up. We were primarily generating revenue through advertising. About 50% of revenue came from there. 30% of our revenue came from affiliate deals, meaning if we helped to drive traffic or sell, again, like movie tickets, CDs, DVDs, posters, etc., we would either get paid when people clicked over, or we would get paid when a percentage of when they purchased a ticket or a movie poster or stuff like that. Later, as we got bigger, we actually started licensing some of our data out to different partners. And in some situations, they would pay us. So later on, that became around 20% of our revenue.
Right, right. I like that point about how, you know, when people are using Rotten Tomatoes to decide what they want to watch, it opens up a lot of avenues for them to be in a position to consume. And so that, you know, I would say would probably be one of the driving factors behind that 30% of the affiliate deals. And then obviously, you know, the whole data, when you're able to license that, you know, then that's around like the 20% of the of your entire revenue. So super cool concept. But, you know, like you mentioned, the dot-com bubble and crash eventually. What was the experience like, right, going through that while still holding the fort down with Rotten Tomatoes, and how that impact your work with, you know, with what you were doing during the event and, you know, after as well?
It was tough time, pretty crazy. It was basically 2 months after we raised was when everything started crashing and all these tech companies started going out of business. A double reason. One is they couldn't raise money anymore because everything was crashing. Investors were getting wiped out. The second is most companies were getting revenue through advertising, and that revenue from advertising was actually coming from other internet companies. So it was just that same money kind of just going in a circle between these different internet companies. And so when the funding dried up, that advertising money dried up, these companies had no way to raise more money, and their primary source of revenue disappeared. And so they were just getting wiped out left and right. For us, at the time, we managed to have... We got a deal with MySimon, which was owned by CNET. It was a price comparison engine, and they were buying all our ad inventory for like $5 CPM, which was a fair deal when we signed it, but it became like a very broken deal. Very good deal for us, very bad deal for them after everything crashed. Ad rates went to like almost nothing. And very lucky for us, they didn't cancel the deal early. It was a one-year deal because I think they forgot about us because they had other problems, bigger problems to deal with. And so that was super lucky. But even with that revenue coming in, we were still losing money every month. So we had to simultaneously try really hard to continue growing our traffic so that we could get more page views so we could get more revenue. We had to massively cut costs. We had to scale back from 20-some people down to 7 over the course of a year. Even at 7, 2 of us went to 0 salary. Everyone else took a 30% pay cut. So we had 7 people, but it was probably the equivalent of like 3.5 people, something in that range. We subleased some of our office space out because we suddenly had a lot more space. You know, we did everything we could to cut our costs down, and we were able to get pretty much to break even after about a year or so. But it was really tough. You know, in my case, I was one of the two people that went to zero. I got rid of my apartment and I just moved into the office actually because we had so many of these like, you know, cubes for 25 people down to 7. So I just took 3 cubes that were kind of in an L shape and just made that my apartment. And I just put my clothes in and everything into the drawers and just slept under my desk in the evenings. Yeah. And it was fine.
Wow. That's tough. And so, you know, there's from that time, you know, and right now what we're seeing with COVID, right, we're seeing a lot of parallels. What kind of advice, you know, can you give, you know, from your experience, having gone through that, having overcome that, right, that you can give to founders right now having to deal with this?
Yeah. So there have been a couple of crazy times in history. The internet bubble bursting in 2000, 18 months after it burst, was 9/11. And in 2008 was also pretty bad. And I would say what's happening now with COVID is like worse than all three of those combined. Like it's just crazy right now. I think though in this situation, you know, in terms of like deaths, it's definitely way more than those. But also just the economic impact. A lot of people, you know, without jobs. This one, though, is hitting retail, hospitality, travel much, much harder. It hasn't hurt tech companies as much. Actually, a lot of tech companies have gained in value and are doing fine outside of, you know, ones like in the travel or hospitality, you know, like an Airbnb or something. But, you know, if you're Zoom, you're doing great. The biggest lesson I learned from the previous times was you can't necessarily control your revenue. And especially if, you know, let's say you're in retail or something else, like your revenue probably went to zero for a long time, unless you were able to be very creative and maybe you switched to like takeout orders, delivery, ghost kitchen, something like that, if you're like a restaurant. But the one thing you can control is your cost. And so, you know, if you cut staff, if you furlough people, it's not easy, but it's something you can do. There's two ways to get to break even. It's basically when your revenue and your cost match, then you're at break even. And if your revenue, if you can't push that up, you can at least push your cost down. And at some point, hopefully you can get your cost to match your revenue so you can live through this. Or if you can't, at least you can lower your burn rate enough that you can get through it. When all this stuff started happening, I was telling, you know, founders, do whatever you can to give yourself 18 months runway. That was my feeling of like how long it would take for it to like kind of things to get normal again.
Right. That, I think that's super important. And I think that's, you know, by just condensing it and looking at it from a very macro perspective, when you're able to either push the benefit or run the cost down, then that's also that, you know, either way would be a way of just staying afloat. But then obviously, you know, if you can't be able to push the benefit higher than it is, just based off of, you know, the unpredictability of the market, the fact that people are not paying at the moment, not consuming as much, then, you know, the next best thing would be to run the cost down, like you said, you know, to, you know, either let go of people or to do very, you know, do really constructive, sharp steps to be able to stay afloat during these hard times. And you know, I think it's a huge takeaway for founders right now, and especially with the 18-month runway, I think that's significantly important. I think something to keep in mind with. Eventually, you know, what was the process like when Rotten Tomatoes was acquired by IGN Entertainment? You know, what were some of the considerations that you had, right, that made you feel that, you know, that that was the right decision at the right time to make?
To be honest, looking back, it probably was the wrong decision, but I think at the time, because we went through such crazy times, like right after we raised, it was the first company where we actually raised funding, because the previous two, the first one, we just put our own money in. The second one, we took a loan, and these were very small amounts. And then suddenly we raised for $1 million, which for us at the time felt like a lot of money. And then market, you know, crashes, 9/11, and we're just going through these really tough times, having to let go of everyone, almost everyone. And so when things finally started looking up, you know, we had gotten to break even, we managed to start getting profitable, our traffic continued to grow, our brand continued to grow, we started getting offers. And the first sets of offers we got, we were like, you know, they're like 10 cents, 25 cents on the dollar as far as our post-money valuation. And we felt like, well, we don't want to sell and make our investors lose money. We at least should try and get them their money back. So that was really the only bar we had. And once we got this offer from IGN where our investors would actually make a return, it wasn't like a huge return, but they actually were making money, whereas everything else they invested in during that time probably went to zero. And so we talked to them about it and we thought, okay, it makes sense. We tried to negotiate up a little bit and they agreed, but they asked us to do a no shop and we're like, sure. For us, the big mistake we had was we didn't have enough like outside advisors, mentors, things like that, that could kind of tell us like, is this the right time to sell? How to sell? You know, how to get competitive offers? Should we use a bank or not? Like lots of like very important information you should have for something like this, because it doesn't happen very often that you have something valuable enough to sell. And I think part of it was just as entrepreneurs, or at least for me, we were just used to like doing what we thought made sense and kind of learn by trial and error. But you don't get many tries to do this. And so it's the kind of thing that when it comes around, you kind of want to get it right on the first try. So I do think looking back, it was kind of a mistake. The timing of it, how we did it, all that stuff could have been handled a lot better, optimized a lot better. But at least, you know, again, we were able to sell. We made our investors money. We were able to make a little bit of money for all the employees and team. So I think, you know, and then the site is still around. The brand is still quite strong.
Right, of course. And I think you bring up two really amazing points that resonate with me. The first point being that, you know, as a founder, you do have that responsibility to be able to at least return the money back to, you know, your investors. You know, even if you're not able to provide, you know, profit, you know, the very bare minimum would be to return what they at least invested in you with. The second point is that, you know, you mentioned that at that time, you know, you would have been well better positioned to be able to make that decision if you had, you know, some advice or mentorship. And I think it speaks very much to have a very strong ecosystem where you're able to, where it's a very fluid pipeline of mentors to young founders, entrepreneurs, and all that knowledge, right? Access to knowledge, access to, you know, very basic information. I think having a strong ecosystem, you know, is extremely beneficial to everyone that's part of it, right? In that little ecosystem, whether, you know, you're an investor, operator, or whatever you're doing, right? Making the right decision at the right times. You know, you did mention, you know, that for you, at looking back, it was kind of the wrong decision to make. But, you know, what would you have done differently with that? Having, you know, now known what Rotten Tomatoes would have become, you know, what would you have done differently at that time?
I think biggest mistake was myself and my co-founders, we were all quite introverted. We were all quite shy, and we didn't really do any kind of networking. We were based in Emeryville, which is in the Bay Area. But, you know, we're a tech company. We're not in San Francisco. We're not in Silicon Valley. We're also a movie site. We're covering movies, and we're not in Hollywood. So we didn't really know almost anyone in Hollywood outside of like the marketing departments at studios. And then on the tech side too, we barely knew anyone. We didn't know any VCs really. And so that, I would say, was actually the biggest mistake was, you know, I was a CEO and I was just focused on running the company and surviving. And I wasn't really spending any time getting out there and meeting people. And I think I should have spent, you know, at least like 10 or 20% getting out there, increasing my network. Because if I had known more people, they didn't actually have to be formal advisors or mentors or anything, but just if I had more people that I knew that had more knowledge, that would have helped a lot just to bounce things off of. We sold in 2004. I don't remember when Y Combinator started, but I feel like we were probably pre-Y Combinator. Like There weren't really, I don't think, any accelerators yet. There weren't really any incubators outside of, I think, Idea Labs based out in LA. They were like the first incubator that I know of. Now I don't know, but like before COVID, there's just so many mixers and events and conferences, and there's so many resources now for founders that I don't think were anywhere near as widely available when we were running stuff. So we were kind of operating somewhat blind. The biggest thing I could have done was get out there, network some more, meet more people, and just have more knowledge before coming in to try and negotiate a sale.
Right. And thank you so much for being so candid about your experience. I think, you know, it's such a great learning opportunity for at least young founders right now that are listening to this to be able to take away. And you know, you did bring up a point where Rotten Tomatoes, that you're not situated either in Hollywood or in Silicon Valley, that, you know, maybe those, if you had been, then that would have opened up avenues and access to more opportunities. But again, you know, speaking to the importance of having an ecosystem, whether it be, you know, situated outside of, you know, the key areas, you know, just being able to have that access to a network, I think is really important. You know, but with Rotten Tomatoes, I would not be able to fathom having created a product that is so accessible, that is so as famous as Rotten Tomatoes is, monthly unique visitors at like 26 million, you know, every month, right? People can only dream about getting this kind of traffic. Did you at all foresee that Rotten Tomatoes, you know, would ever grow to this point? And what do you think really underpinned this kind of success?
Well, when Sen first launched it and it was just a hobby site, you just had no idea. You know, we're like, it's cool. People were, you know, got featured once or twice. You know, oh, Roger Ebert wrote about it. Oh, Pixar's using it. That's really cool. But we didn't think it was going to be like this, like where it's just like the de facto score for movies. We kind of had a better idea when we were selling it. I remember I think it was The Daily Show. And I don't normally watch it, but my roommate, who was also one of our editors at the time, he watched The Daily Show like every day. And I just happened to be outside microwaving some food to eat dinner. I'm watching The Daily Show with him. And then it was like Jon Stewart, and he was interviewing Mark Ruffalo. And as he's talking to Mark Ruffalo, Jon Stewart's just like, have you ever heard of Rotten Tomatoes? And Mark Ruffalo's like, no. And then Jon Stewart just starts explaining Rotten Tomatoes. It was crazy because it was the first time for me and my roommate, and I'm actually watching something on TV and someone starts talking about Rotten Tomatoes, and I didn't, you know, answer anything like that. And we were freaking out. We were grabbing our cell phones. We were trying to call our friends. And I think at that point, we're like, wow, what the heck? And I think around the time is also when we sold it. So maybe that should have been a sign to be like, hey, maybe we should wait this out a little longer.
That's when you know you made it, right? When Jon Stewart from The Daily Show starts explaining your product to you know, other celebrities. But you know, during your time with Rotten Tomatoes, what were some of the main challenges that you faced, right? You know, ranging from the product side, or you know, raising money, you know, was it the tech dev side of things, you know, and how did you overcome them, you know, in the end?
So I mean, the biggest challenges were the bubble bursting and 9/11 and letting go of all those people and trying to deal with where our business model was dependent on advertising revenue, but the advertising rates were going through the floor, like they were just dropping like crazy. In our case, we were very lucky where the three main founders, myself, Steve, and Sen, were very complimentary. We didn't bump into each other much. What worked well for us was we didn't put things to a vote. Even though there's three of us, you could easily do that. We were like, no, we must all agree, like wholeheartedly agree on the direction. And sometimes we didn't always agree. And we would have to sit in a room for hours or even sometimes days and talk it out, argue it out if we had to. until we could come to like, this is what we think makes the most sense. And all three of us were behind it. As far as challenges go, you know, revenue was incredibly challenging because the rates just kept dropping. And so we had to figure out what else could work. So, you know, affiliate deals work really well because there's no real risk for the other side. They only pay if a click comes over, or they only pay when we sell a movie ticket or a poster or whatever. That starts taking more of the revenue. Trying to work with the studios to figure out what makes the most sense for them. And advertising was always tough for us because our site, you know, a studio could buy ads for a movie and they're buying it well in advance of the movie coming out. Movie comes out and it's super rotten. It was always a problem. You know, the director of the movie or producers of the movie or the studios themselves, the marketing people would call, in some cases kind of try and threaten. In some rare cases, maybe we might have misclassified a movie that was rotten or that was fresh as rotten. And what we do in those cases, we reread it. We're like, oh, that does seem off. We would go in, check with the critic and be like, do you think it's actually fresh or rotten? And they would tell us. Mm-hmm. Later on, we built a system to allow critics to submit themselves. So on the revenue side, yeah, trying to just figure out how to get more revenue, consistent revenue when ad rates were dropping. On the product side, you know, a lot of automation. We had, when we first started, because everything was static HTML, we had like 10 of our folks, you know, that we brought over from a design firm, trying to grab reviews. And then we started writing down and automating some of that process, built a content management system, make it faster, started getting parsers to actually grab the reviews to one place to again speed things up. So there's all that. And on the product side, you know, just like, again, how do you increase traffic? How do you increase engagement, retention, page views, without like compromising the quality of the site and what it's about? So these were always all the different kinds of challenges that we were facing. And what was good is because we had three of us, each one would kind of worry about their own domain, and we would just keep constantly syncing up. And because we had such a small team, I mean, we were 7 for most of the time we were running it, and towards the end we went up to 10. You know, it was pretty easy to kind of stay in sync.
Right. And I think just having that kind of unity within the core team of the three of you, and having a really strong idea of where you want, you know, Rotten Tomatoes to grow towards, what that would look like in terms of the revenue, business, product side of things. I think having that consensus, you know, even if it meant, you know, taking days out to really talk it out and argue it out, but to come to a final consensus, I think that builds a very strong base and foundation for the product to grow as well as for the company to grow, right? And you're able to translate that kind of company culture to, you know, not just 3 people, but then to 10 people and then to 20 people. I think it really comes down to having that really core base. To wrap things up, Patrick, I do want to give you an explanation to the title of the podcast, Scalescape. And so when we're breaking the word Scalescape down, right, when we're scaling a company, when we're trying to grow a company, we need to take into account, right, the external factors like the geography, the timing, product market fit, yada, 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 the list goes on. What is one tip that you can give to founders right now to Scalescape their companies towards success?
I would say for one thing I learned across my 6 companies, again, most of my companies didn't work. And then the ones that did work, probably the best, were obviously Rotten Tomatoes, as well as our design from before Rotten Tomatoes, but which we ended up giving to another group to take over. And when I started looking at the ones that failed versus the ones that succeeded, I started seeing a pattern. And basically that pattern was focus. The ones that worked were extremely focused as far as the features, the categories they covered, the markets they covered, as opposed to the ones that didn't work, we were trying to do too much. We were trying to build the kitchen sink, right? Mm-hmm. Rotten Tomatoes was just reviews for movies. Our design firm at the time when we ran it was just web design for the entertainment industry, extremely focused. And when I started looking at, you know, all the other companies I could think of, just about all of them started off super focused, right? Facebook was just launched in Harvard. Amazon only did books until they IPO'd, selling books. Google was only doing search. Even fast food chains, you got the hamburger selling ones, you got Taco Bell, Panda Express, Pizza Hut. It goes on and on. The biggest mistake I made with the companies that failed, and the biggest mistake I see among lots of entrepreneurs, most entrepreneurs, especially first-time founders, early-stage companies, but you'll even see it in big ones like a WeWork, is just being unfocused and trying to do too many things with the resources you have. And it doesn't matter how many resources you have. Like, you can't, you know, you can't boil the ocean. And so the biggest thing is to see the resources you have and to make sure that the scale of what you're trying to do, the scope of what you're trying to do, makes sense relative to your resources. Sen was able to launch Rotten Tomatoes by himself in 2 weeks, and he couldn't code. And a lot of companies, a lot of things, you can do something similar, right? Oh, you want to do a hardware product? Well, launch on Kickstarter. Oh, you have this other idea for something you think people want? Make a landing page. You know, you don't actually have to build a product or do surveys, right? Or you look at Craigslist, AngelList. I mean, they were just mailing lists to start with. And actually, a lot of marketplaces, you probably could, version 0.1 of that could be a mailing list and just see if you can get buyers and sellers on there and see if you can get transactions going, because you just want to figure out if people want it. And that would be my single biggest advice is, like, I think if you actually focus, you actually end up with a bigger company than trying to do everything. And a really good example of that, I believe, is look at Justin TV, right? Justin TV was like this, you know, live streaming of one person. And then they kind of split it and made two companies from that. Social Cam, which was kind of like Justin TV for everything. And then there was Twitch, which was Justin TV for gaming. And Social Cam, I don't think exists anymore. And Twitch, you know, sold for $1 billion to Amazon. And I think if Twitch was available right now, it'd probably be worth at least 10x that. By actually focusing, you actually end up with something bigger. It happened to me 2 times out of 6. And I think almost every case I can think of, go back to the way beginning and see what they're doing. And they probably weren't building the kitchen sink. They were probably extremely crazy focused. And so that would be my single piece of advice, I think, is literally the most important piece of advice that for any founder.
And that's super insightful, Patrick. I think by having that kind of focus, you know, too often people are trying to think about the different products, features, yada, yada, yada. You know, whereas when, you know, you're not tunnel visioning necessarily, but by focusing on that one really core value proposition, that really core feature, then you're able to scale that and then just grow from there. I think that is such a great way to end the episode. Patrick, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, again, I really enjoyed being on the show, and thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Stay tuned on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for the giveaway announcement. I'll see you next week.